are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This begins Disc 3.
Chapter 16, Seeing. It was 1954 when I stood looking directly into the sun's face from a hospital room in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Mama sat in the chair next to the bed I would not get into. I knew she hated it when I stared directly at the sun, but I loved the sunshine. It had always been there, and when it looked at me, I felt as though I was a part of that bright light. The cataract was going to be removed from my left eye the next morning, which was Friday. The right eye had been operated on when I was not even 2 years old, became infected, then totally blind. This meant that if something went wrong, I may not see the sun anymore, so I stared at it, hoping to receive the light inside my body to shine out of my eye after the surgery was over. Finally, the nurse came in with supper. The train rumbled outside as Mama and I tried to go to sleep. It reminded me of school, and I thought about my best friend, Anne, and wished she knew that I was here. My friends from school seemed closer as the train kept me from sleeping, and before I knew it, morning had come. "I want to brush my teeth," I said to Mama. "No," Mama said. "The nurse said no water." "I won't drink any," I promised. "I can't stand to go into the ether with my teeth not brushed." I remembered the ether from having my tonsils out in the infirmary at school last year. "The ether tastes awful," I said as I begged for my toothbrush. So, teeth brushed and no water swallowed, I was put on a gurney and wheeled away from my mama and put under the bright hospital lights, which were still not as bright as my son. I thought about having my tonsils out at school last year and dreaded the mask over my face and that smell. "What do you like to do most?" the nurse asked me. "Sing," I told her. "What else?" she asked. "Ride the merry-go-round," I said. Then my trip into the twilight zone began. "You're going round and round and round," the nurse said. "Round and round and round you go. Round and round and..." Suddenly, the stool she was standing on flipped, and she caught herself with the hand that was holding the smell over my nose, and my mind began going round and round and round. "Anne, listen to that wind!" Hurricane Hazel was in Raleigh, snapping off limbs. Anne and I ran to the window and raised it just a little. The sound of the wind screaming and the trees and limbs snapping sounded like hands clapping. Then there was a total quiet, and Anne and I went outside the gymnasium where we were and stood in the middle of Hazel's eye. It was such a quiet place, like black with no night. Bells with ringing, but no noise. Words with no sound. Then, as suddenly as the quietness had come, the wind lifted us from the porch. We held on to the big columns of the building, but felt ourselves going round and round and round. We tried to breathe, but could not. We took our hands and grabbed the wind, pushing it down our throats as we rushed toward the door that opened all by itself and blew us inside. The gym teacher was shaking us, and I tried to fight, but Anne disappeared, and then I remembered. It was the ether down my throat, and the nurse was shaking me awake. I came awake with a vengeance. My stomach woke up first and quickly started ridding its contents of ether and anything else that was in it, including the water that I did not drink. For hours, everybody scurried around me, frantically trying to keep me from jarring the very tenuous, fragile eye. I lapsed in and out of consciousness. Mama was crying. "I talk to the man upstairs when I feel like that," the nurse told Mama. "I have talked to him all day long," Mama said. Why was Mama talking to the man upstairs? Dorothy and Hattie had told Anne and me ghost stories about a man that had lost his golden arm, and every night he walked around on the roof and the tops of the infirmary looking for his arm. But why would Mama be talking to him all day long? More throwing up, more rushing around. "I wish everybody in this hospital felt as bad as I do," I said. "Honey," Mama said, "that's a very mean thing to say, and you don't mean it." "Yes, I do. Nobody will ever know how awful I feel until they feel as bad as I do." "You should not want anybody to feel bad," Mama said. "Am I crying?" I asked as I reached up to touch my face. Before I got far enough, the nurse grabbed my hand. "Let's be still now," she said. "You have to keep your eye very still." "I can see," I announced. "Your eye is covered up with bandages and a large shield," the nurse said. "You can't possibly see." "Yes, I can," I said. "You can always see something whether you think you can or not. You can even see darkness whether you know you can or not. If not, it would be like looking out of your nose or ear or something. You can't see out of those at all, but you can see darkness behind a bandage out of your eye." "She's delirious again," the nurse said, and I stuck my tongue out, hoping to fill the bandage with it. "Please give me some water," I begged. "Water is what got you into this mess," the nurse said. Suddenly, I felt like my teeth were following my tongue out of my mouth. They stood there in front of me, jumping up and down while I tried to catch them with my toothbrush, and they kept on dancing just out of reach. I started giggling at the game while a new nurse came in to relieve the one who had spent the long night beside my bed. It was a terrible night that I thought would never end, but it did end. It ended with my doctor coming in and feeding me ice chips and rubbing my head. He was my hero, and I could not wait to find out if I could see his face. It was 4 days before he dared chance lifting the bandages. My world was fuzzy, and all I could see was the point of a bright light he shone into my wounded vision. "It hurts," I almost shouted. "That's because you can see better," he said, as his fuzzy face took shape slowly around my vision. It looked like dark hair, large eyes. Oh, my goodness! I could see his eyes. I had never seen anybody's eyes before. My world would change, not dramatically, but change it did. It took a while for me to figure things out. Things I had touched somehow did not look as I thought they would when I saw them. Even though I knew I would still have to go to the school for the blind, suddenly I could see shapes and soon learned to recognize the faces of my family. Colors became as bright as my son used to be, and I found out I couldn't even look up at the sky without wincing, even on a cloudy day. The only downside to my seeing was that I would wear thick glasses. They were heavy, and I kept making faces trying to push them up higher and higher. However, the fact of seeing things was worth it, even if I did think the glasses were ugly. All my family was so excited that I could see things. Granny Kimbrell, Mama's mother, lived uptown. She had bought me a Braille Bible as soon as I was old enough to read one, and she told me that she was going to buy me some hose and a prom dress as soon as I needed one. Granny opened up her house. "I want you to go in every single room and look around," she said. "I want you to see all there is to see in this house, good and bad, and if you don't know what something is, I'll just tell you." I wandered shyly through the house, and my eyes fell on a clock on her mantle. It was a horse with a clock on its back, gold, and it fascinated me as the cowboy's lasso turned round and around when it chimed the hour. On a high shelf there was a large coconut, almost as large as a watermelon, with a face made on it with funny-looking marble eyes. She said her son had sent it to her once while in the Second World War before he died. Until that moment, I had not realized my uncle, Richard Kimbrell, had died at all. Even though I never saw him much in my early life, now he became one of those things that had changed, moved away, disappeared. I was too excited about seeing to grieve, yet somehow there was a pang of sadness where he had lived in his place of my knowing. I hugged Granny, and she was the one who hugged everybody, whether they liked it or not. Now, she just wanted to be happy for me because I could see some things, and I felt like I could talk to her forever. Before going back to school, Daddy took me to the Smoky Mountains. Daddy had taken us many times to the Smoky and Blue Ridge Mountains, but I had no words to say when he took us about a month after the surgery. I was amazed and speechless when I really could see the smoky haze that seemed to drift into the Blue Ridges. I sat quietly in a new place in my mind, in my heart, somewhere far beyond the car windows while riding back to Lexington. I stood on the front porch of the house Mama and Daddy and Larry had moved in while I was at school in the first grade. The swing was green, the porch was green, and the trees in the front yard seemed to bow their young heads. The corn really was as high as an elephant's eye, like the song I had sung in voice. The light green shucks and the darker green stalk that I pulled off the white and yellow corn inside fascinated me. Even though I still could not color well, I could see the outlines in the book, and Mama bought me coloring books and crayons. I spent hours making colors on the pages. I wondered what school looked like, what Anne looked like, what my world would be in Cook Cottage. Chapter 17, Cook Cottage. At home, my eye surgery had helped me see better, but it seemed like I was still very blind in Lexington. At school, it suddenly seemed like I could see very well. Anne's hair was a beautiful blonde color, which shone like bright sunshine. Anne pulled the pretty hair back from her face, exposing big, bright blue eyes. I was also glad to see Laverne and Sally again, as well as some of the other girls who had moved up to Cook before me. Sally's hair was a chestnut color that I had never seen before. Anne's hair was blonder than mine, and I often tried to find a crayon to match Anne or Sally's hair colors, but I never did find one that worked for either. I was surprised to see how beautiful the campus really was. It was autumn, and the leaves were just beginning to change their clothes for the seasons. I would sit outside on the porch of Cook Cottage, trying to just watch them change or color a little girl's skirt and blouse. I would walk down the sidewalk and gaze at the gymnasium with its big columns and many windows where we had stood for Hurricane Hazel. The principal's house was just down the street from Cook Cottage. It was new, and he had planted rose gardens in the back. The sun seemed to lie down just behind the infirmary across from his house every evening, and I imagined watching Mama and Daddy driving down that way toward Western Boulevard and Highway 64. There was a playground between buildings Cook and Fisher with swings that carried us higher and higher almost every afternoon. The building had two floors, and we lived on the second floor. It had a large porch as well, but not nearly as large as the one in Kay Cottage. There were no roofs over the porch except for the one just outside the door. As all our buildings did, Cook had many cane-bottom rockers along the brick linings around the porch. Cook Cottage was the perfect place for transition from little to big and not big enough. In Cook Cottage, we were all responsible for our clothes, which we shared in a closet with another girl. We kept up with our own money. We could let our hair grow out as long as we wanted to, and no one would cut it off, as long as we were able to keep it clean and ordered. There was a television in the recreation room downstairs. On Saturdays, Anne and I would watch Roy Rogers and sing Happy Trails all week. I begged Miss Davis to let Anne come to voice lessons and let us sing Happy Trails, but she would not. This year, there was a new girl named Carolyn Scott. Carolyn was the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. She looked like an angel surely must look, and talk like an angel surely must talk. Her hair was brown, and her face smiled all the way into her eyes. I could never tell exactly what color her eyes really were, because they seemed to change shades every time she wore a different color. Her parents told the school officials that Carolyn had been taking voice and dance lessons. Soon, Miss Davis had her singing on stage, and she went with us to those Lions clubs and churches. Her voice was so beautiful. I almost cried listening to her sing. It never occurred to me that this poised, classy young lady came from a well-to-do family. All I knew was that I wanted to be just like her, dressed like her, sing like her. I stuck to her like glue, sometimes leaving Anne to watch TV by herself or with the other girls who enjoyed TV too. Still, Anne and I were in the same class when we went for an Easter egg hunt. No matter how good I could now see, hunting Easter eggs was not fun. I could not distinguish the pretty colored eggs from the pretty colored grass. Anne saw me struggling with only a few eggs in my basket, and she began dropping eggs right in front of me. As we grew, Anne seemed to continue to see better and better. I don't even remember when she began reading my true stories out of a magazine. Some of us would sit around her for as long as she would read to us. We began learning about growing up through these stories. As I grew, my voice began to try to change into a teenager's voice, seeming at times to be uncontrollable. Suddenly, I was singing alto to Carolyn's gorgeous soprano. This was fine with me. Just so I got to sing with her, it didn't matter what part I sang. Days and nights passed into more days and nights. Our first house mother was named Mrs. Oates. She was old, and every Sunday evening she would always say, "Now, girls, I am tired, you are tired, and we are all tired, so let's be quiet." Our lights were turned out at 9:30 p.m. If we were in rooms 1 or 2, we could listen to the music from the radios of the girls in Fisher Cottage next door. There was a radio program called Our Best to You, hosted by Russell Capps, who played popular love songs. In those days, people could call into the station and dedicate certain songs to individual people. Downstairs in the building was a home economics room, where a dining room would have been if we had one. We went to eat with the older girls in Fisher Cottage next door. We sat 8 to a table throughout the large room. It had been years since I could rake food off the plate into my mouth, and I learned to pass the food around, taking it from the bowls without spilling anything. Anne loved the fact that she no longer had to try to eat turnip greens, and I suddenly realized I didn't know what I liked to eat and what I didn't. Chapter 18. Church in Cook. When we first entered Cook, an adult chaperone came every Sunday morning to walk with us to Pullen Memorial Baptist Church, about a mile or so from campus. We all lined up in a line and made an entrance that surely was recognized by all the church members. We did this every Sunday for our first 2 years. Then someone decided that those who could see would just walk the trip together. Many of the girls were assigned to churches in town, and cabs pulled up every Sunday in a line, picking up girls in different churches. I was assigned to go to Pullen Memorial Baptist Church, along with some of my friends, including Laverne, Barbara Taylor, and Janice Fan. Since I could now see better, I was allowed to be a chaperone. Sally had taught me the way to go to the drugstore and where Cameron Village was. I was allowed every week to take anybody in Cook Cottage who wanted to go to the drugstore or to Cameron Village off campus. Anne was a chaperone as well, which means usually we didn't get to go off campus together because we're always taking somebody who needed a chaperone. This was when I realized seeing was a great thing. There were still some girls and boys who could read print faster than me and see better than me. But I was a chaperone, and I loved it. So, Every Sunday, those of us who had been chosen for pulling had to trudge that mile, rain or shine, hot or cold. High heels just made the trip more arduous. Church was an interesting phenomenon in Raleigh. It seemed as though they did not know what to do with a lot of little blind kids from the State School for the Blind, and they created a class for us. This meant that the same girls would go into a class we could have been in without even leaving Cook. So, as our transition began from children to adolescence and all its questions and uncertainties, we were made to feel awkward in a situation where comfort did not prevail. Not to worry, we began exploring new ways to make our church life more interesting. At first, we began counting the words that the preacher said that we did not understand. This lasted for about 2 Sundays, and we realized there must be something more interesting to do. There were lots of society ladies and gentlemen at Pullen Memorial Church. You could tell them by the white gloves that clutched the hymnals, the hats that bobbed on top of their heads when they quickly looked down their noses at one of us blind kids, or the luxurious fur coats that rubbed against us as they pushed us out of their way to get ahead of us. This annoyed me, and I began to get in their way on purpose. Then I had a better idea. In the vestibule, there was a tall lady with short, light brown hair, large-rimmed glasses, and a long fur coat. She carried a large gray purse and was busy putting her church bulletin inside it. "Laverne," I said, taking her hand and lifting it high, "feel all these hundreds of little minks." Laverne's hand went down the large fur coat under my guidance, then lifted and did it again, stroking the coat as if it were alive. A hat bobbed. A gloved hand grabbed my wrist as the other one grabbed the stole, doing a little dance, trying to balance the coat, the bulletin, the purse, and me. "Don't they teach you girls anything at that school?" The lady's voice snarled at us as she shook my arm and stared at me as though I had just grown horns. Laverne was terrified, not thinking this was funny one bit. "Yes, they do," she assured the lady. "Just some people who go there have trouble learning." After that, it was back to counting big words the preacher said and being bored until we thought of something more fun, and eventually we did. Chapter 19, Snow Story. It snowed in North Carolina the day I was to go back to school after Christmas break. Larry and I made snowballs. It had been such a long time since we had played together in the snow that all the snowballs I threw went from my heart into my hands and aimed themselves carefully toward the sound of Larry's voice. By the time they ever got close, I would hear Larry laughing from behind me, and a brand new crunchy ball would land somewhere around my shoulders. "You ain't fair, Larry," I whined as I picked up another handful of snow and crunched it inside my gloved fist. "I hate playing with girls," Larry said. "They don't care how hard they throw a snowball, but once they get hit, they start whining." "But I ain't hit you with one yet," I said, as I threw the ball with all my might into a tree. I quickly bent over to pick up another one, and Larry came from behind me, pushing me face down into the snow. Just then, Mama came out the back door. "Larry, stop that. You know she can't see you good enough to throw snowballs while you are running." I was getting up from the snow. I didn't bother to brush off my face or my clothes. All I knew was that Larry was standing close behind me. I knew he would be looking at Mama to say something. I gathered up my wits, and as he started to speak, I drove the snow like a flyball right into Larry's face. "Aha!" I shouted, and Larry started to chase me through the frozen cornfield, neither of us paying attention to Mama. We started making snow boys and girls, rolling snow from the end of the cornfield all the way into the front yard, so that by the time we got it there, it took both of us pushing as hard as we could to roll it and stand it up. My heart was pounding in my chest with the fun of playing with Larry and the snow. I ran inside to get some old clothes to dress the snow girl. It surprised me how dull the house looked beside the whiteness of the snow. I found one of my old dresses and picked it up and a straw hat. Mama gave me some hickory nuts to use for the eyes and nose and a piece of red ribbon for the mouth. How are we going to make it stick on? I asked. I don't know, but I'm busy, so you'll have to figure out the mouth, Mama said. Larry and I worked to make real arms for the snow girl so that the dress might fit. It was a summer red dress, and it was too small. Larry said an old coat would look better. I was going back into the house for an old coat, but Larry stopped me. She's too big for your coat, too, he said. Just then, Daddy came from the pasture where he had been looking after the cows and the horses. Better get inside, Punk, he said. We'll have to leave early today so Mama and I can get back home before dark and the roads get worse.
Can't we stay home this time? For a little while, I had forgotten it was Sunday, and I had to go back to school.
Even though school was not as bad to me as it once was, nothing was more fun to me than playing with Larry. He would be 14 in March, and I would be 13 in the summer.
Can we finish our snow people first?
We are leaving in 1 hour, Daddy said. Larry looked at my sad face. Come on and let's hurry, he said. I think I'll make her face look like yours does right now, an old sad sack.
Yes, and when you come out to look at her, then she'll just stick out her red ribbon tongue at you, I said,
and picked up some more snow to put into the girl's hand.
Let's let her hold something, I said.
What? How about a gun and she can be Dale Evans?
No, we don't want a cowboy and a cowgirl.
How about making them singers and we can make the man like Elvis Presley?
I don't think that would work. We'd need a guitar.
Let's just make a farm girl and boy and put an old shirt on the boy, Larry said, and I agreed.
Let's make a dog to go with them, I said, as we went to the open cornfield to roll some more snow.
But just as we got the one big ball back into the front yard, Daddy came out and told me to get in the house and be sure I had everything because we were leaving.
I wouldn't cry, I thought, as I went into the bathroom. For a second, as I stared at the blue tile over the sink, I thought I just might. My toothbrush was already packed, but I closed the door and stood there to order my thoughts for the day. We would ride to Raleigh. I would have Daddy turn on the WTNC Top 10 on the way. I hoped Elvis Presley would be number one again. Daddy might not stop at the monkey store close to Cary because of the weather, but I hoped he would anyway. Then we would get there, and Daddy and Mama would go home, and I would go outside and wait for Ann. I would show Ann the big bride doll I got for Christmas. I was 12 years old, yet loved dolls as much as I did at the age of 6. I smiled as I thought about Ann and wanted to know what she got. We would eat candy and tell each other all about our Christmas vacation. Maybe I would lie and tell Ann that Larry and I made Roy Rogers and Dale Evans in the snow, since she still loved the cowboys and cowgirls every Saturday on TV. Ann and I would sing Happy Trails and forget all about things we left behind. With these thoughts and my day laid straight, I left the bathroom and went into the bedroom to gather anything I had forgotten. Daddy put chains on the wheels of the green and cream Pontiac, and the car sang its way down Highway 64 to Raleigh. Chapter 20, Miracles. Janice Pham was one of the girls who loved to listen to Ann read true stories. Her hair was light brown, and she loved the rock and roll music that was now bombarding all the teenagers in America. I enjoyed going off campus with Janice, even to church, because Janice was so much fun. On one Saturday night, Janice, Shelby Jean, and I had walked downtown to the Ambassador Theater to see Farewell to Arms, starring Rock Hudson and Jennifer Jones. On Sunday morning, Janice and I went to Pullen Church together. The other girls had somewhere else to be. Janice and I talked about going over to the Gateway restaurant between Sunday school and church to get ice cream. The plan was to get the ice cream, eat it, and then come back to the 11 o'clock service. The weather was warm. Janice wore white shoes and a pink skirt and sweater. The sweater was pulled down tight over the top of her skirt, showing off her new figure. I wore a green and white dress with buttons on the shoulders and white high heels. Janice's eyes were very small, and she kept them almost closed most of the time, as she could not see anything at all. She trusted me to be our guide. I could see from one side of the street to the other, and even see the buildings on the other side, but I couldn't read the signs with the names of the buildings on them or the street signs across the other side. We were talking about last night's movie as we started crossing Hillsborough Street in Raleigh. We had sneaked out the back door of Sunday school so we would have plenty of time to eat a banana split or a chocolate sundae. I looked at the red light and we stepped off the curb into the street lined with cars on each side. As we got about halfway across the street, something happened. I could see cars turning right in front of us. Nobody ever told me about how cars could turn into a lane right in front of people. For a minute, I held Janice's arms tight as we stood frozen as more cars began to turn. I panicked, thinking that soon the cars on the other side of the street just behind us would start and we would be caught there in the middle of heavy Hillsborough Street traffic. I turned Janice around and started pulling her rapidly back toward the curb we had just stepped off. In the meantime, the light had changed and cars seemed to be coming in all directions. I saw the car, big and gray and fast. At first, I screamed because I wanted the car to stop and because I knew it wouldn't. And then I screamed because I was high in the air, higher than the car, headed down toward the pavement. I never felt myself hit the pavement. Janice was on my other side, but she didn't scream, and she couldn't even see exactly what had happened. According to what people told me, evidently, I had screamed loud enough to disrupt the church service, and lots of onlookers came out to see two little blind girls in the street being put into an ambulance. The principal was called and went straight to Rex Hospital with his wife. I called his wife Mama the whole time she was there because I said she had on Mama's blue dress. I don't remember X-rays being taken or seeing a doctor. We were then taken back of the campus, me still unconscious, where it was reported to me that Larry Kendrick carried me into the infirmary with our friends looking on. Finally, late in the day, I began coming around. I realized I was in the infirmary at school, in a cubicle next to Janice. I tried to see, but things were spinning. The white sheets seemed to be over my head, and the white walls seemed to be underneath me. The setting sun shone into the window, and I tried to look hard into its face, hoping it would orient me. My head was heavy, and I could not lift it. Nausea churned my stomach, but I tried hard to keep from vomiting, as I knew it would make my head hurt even worse. For a minute, I thought maybe I was back in the hospital having eye surgery. But when I called Mama, the nurse came running in. "You have a concussion," the nurse said. Mrs. Butler was no longer there, and I didn't know this new nurse. "What were you and Janice doing in the middle of the street, skipping church?" Things began to clear. "Janice?" I asked. I heard Janice answer from the next cubicle. "Janice," I continued calling. "I am so sorry. I am so very sorry. Please forgive me." I couldn't hear Janice answering me, so I kept on and on saying I was sorry until Janice finally woke up and said, "Would you just shut up? I am all right, and next Sunday we will go back to the gateway again." I had a large bump on my head, and I could not move my arm. Janice had some bruises and bumps as well, but somehow I had managed to push Janice forward since she was on the other side of me, and she was only bruised. No one could find my shoes, and my new Easter dress was ruined as it was torn off by hospital personnel. On Monday morning, the man who had hit us came to the infirmary to visit. He told us over and over again how sorry he was. I certainly understood the feeling of being sorry and forgave him. About 3 hours after he left, I went to get a bath in the large tub with the elephant feet. The tub was much larger than the ones in Cook Cottage, and I felt like I could go swimming in it. However, I must have made some kind of noise because the nurse was running into the room, snatching me out of the tub. My arm felt like it broke all over again, and the pain shot all through my body. The next thing I knew, I was wrapped up in a large blanket, back in bed.
You passed out twice, the nurse told me.
I cried with the pain in my arm, just because it seemed like the thing to do.
I was given something for the pain. Billy and some of mine and Janice's classmates came down to visit us late that day. On Tuesday afternoon, we were released from the infirmary.
On Wednesday, during assembly, Mr. Stow read the article in the paper about us.
Janice and I were horrified when someone told us that one of the headlines read, "Blind leads the blind, both fall into a ditch."
"Do you think God is punishing us?" I asked Janice later.
"Good grief, Myra," Janice said. "God is probably only one who knows we were not planning to skip church.
Nobody else believes us. Maybe next time we'll just skip church."
I smiled and hugged Janice, who really didn't want to be hugged.
Chapter 21, Growing Pains. Miss Davis was planning a May Day trip to Kershaw, South Carolina. For weeks I knew about the trip being planned, but Miss Davis had not mentioned it to me. During voice lessons, she had Billy singing lots of solos to pick out the one she was going to have him sing in her church in Kershaw. Carolyn was also going. I waited until the trip was 1 week away before I met Carolyn in the bathroom one morning while she was brushing her teeth. There were six sinks side by side, and other girls stood close by, washing faces and brushing teeth.
"Do you know why I'm not going on the trip with you all this weekend?" I asked.
"Yes," Carolyn answered, but kept on brushing her teeth.
"So why not?" I persisted.
Carolyn rinsed out her toothbrush, laid it on the edge of the sink, then stood up and gave me a little hug, pinching my cheek, and laid her hands gently on my shoulders.
"I think you should ask Miss Davis," she said.
"If you know why I am not going, and she is not telling me, why don't you tell me?"
"Well," Carolyn said, removing her hands from my shoulders, "I don't want to tell you this, but Miss Davis says you talk like you're from the mountains and you dress like you're from the country."
I heard a few gasps coming from other girls at close-by sinks. I stood stunned in the middle of the bathroom floor. Carolyn stood there wearing her blue skirt with the pink flowers and the pink blouse that matched the shade of the pink in the flowers perfectly. Her eyes looked as pretty as usual, but she would not really look directly at me. She picked up her toothbrush and toothpaste and turned to leave the bathroom, giving me a little hug as she passed. I followed her.
"Do you think that is true?"
She turned to face me at the entrance of the hallway that led to our rooms.
"Well, yes, maybe I do," Carolyn said.
"I think you are turning into a teenager, and maybe you could see if you can grow up a little.
You should start being yourself instead of trying to be someone else that you can't be."
"You mean like you?" I asked.
"Yes," Carolyn said.
"You know you try to sing like me. You need to stop that." She turned back into the hallway and headed for her room as I followed her, jumping in front of her to make her stop.
"Did you ask Miss Davis not to take me?" I asked.
She seemed to be annoyed with me as she stopped and looked directly into my face.
"No, but I did tell her I thought maybe you should stop singing while your voice was changing."
"Well, you don't need to worry about me trying to be like you anymore," I said. Yet in my heart I knew I still wanted to be like her. Or maybe I just wanted to know how she managed to always seem so perfect. Anne was waiting for me to walk with her to school. Her ponytail swished from side to side as we walked down the two flights of stairs, then outside and started down the steps in front of Cook, carrying heavy braille books in our arms.
"Do I dress like I'm from the country?" I asked Anne.
"I think we all must dress like we are from the country except Carolyn," Anne said. I almost laughed.
"I guess we all must talk like we're from the mountains, too," I said.
"Well, now," Anne laughed,
"you do talk a little bit different than Carolyn does."
"Everybody talks different from Carolyn does also," I said. "But you are right.
I need to try to work on English harder.
Let's go skating this afternoon after school, Anne said, and we did.
The next afternoon, I had my voice lesson with Billy. I went and sat down in the front row of chairs in the spacious room. Billy came and sat down beside me. Do you think I talk like I'm from the mountains and dress like I'm from the country? I asked Billy.
No, he said. Who said that?
Carolyn and Miss Davis think so, I said, just as Miss Davis came into the room. I'm not going on the trip this weekend, Billy said to her.
Why not? She asked.
I'm not going unless Myra does, he said. Tears began to burn my eyes. I wanted to run to the bathroom or anywhere but here.
Myra is going, Miss Davis said.
Whoever said she wasn't? After the trip, I told Mama what Carolyn and Miss Davis had said. Mama's feelings were terribly hurt.
You are turning into a teenager far away from me, and I can't even help you, Mama said.
I will fix it so nobody ever says anything like that to you again.
From that day on, Mama bought materials and patterns in the latest styles and made lots and lots of new clothes for me to wear.
The week after the trip, I went over to Cameron Village and had my hair cut off in an Elvis Presley ducktail.
Why did you do that? Billy asked.
Well, I answered, I don't look like I came from the country anymore. I look like I came from Tennessee.
No, now you look like you are from Mars, he said.
Chapter 22, Rock and Roll. All of us were ecstatic.
Mrs. Polly Grimes, one of our favorite teachers, had helped pull some strings and get Pat Boone to come on campus and sing for the students at the school. He was at the state fair. She realized how special it would be for him to come.
We did not know how many strings Miss Grimes had to pull for the event, but we hoped she knew how wonderfully exciting this was for us all.
Anne and I could barely stand waiting.
We wanted to be the ones to welcome him to our campus, but, of course, Mr. Stow did that. Anne and I sat just across the aisle from each other in the large auditorium. There was a feeling of excitement all over the place, and I wondered if it was Anne and me causing it all. Of course, it was everyone who listened to the radio. Finally, the waiting was over. Pat Boone stood right there on our stage, where we all stood for school programs, wearing his white shoes. His latest hit was I'll Be Home. We listened to Love Letters in the Sand, April Love, and Twixt 12 and 20. Anne and I reached the distance between our seats and held each other's hands, squeezing them mercilessly in our excitement. Both of us let out a loud sigh when he finally did sing, I'll Be Home. Then we ran down the aisle to shake his hand. We both became suddenly shy when meeting him, not knowing at all what to say. We were thrilled when he handed both of us a picture which he personally autographed for us. The only thing that could have been better to me was if it had been Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley was going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show one Sunday evening soon. I staked out my place in the recreation room right in front of the TV over an hour early. Someone said that Janice Allen had fallen. Janice Allen was from Four Oaks and was a grade behind me in school. She had some trouble with her knees. I wanted to go see what was going on, but I couldn't risk losing my place. The recreation room began to fill up with girls who were as excited as we were when Pat Boone had visited. We squealed and clapped, but I would not jump or down because I wanted to see totally every move he made. During the Ed Sullivan Show, the nurse came into the building to check on Janice, who was doing better. On her way out, the nurse, another new one, saw me with my head directly in the TV, glaring at one long-haired, sideburned, shaking guitar player who was singing, You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog.
Chapter 23, Twixt 12 and Teens.
The next morning, I woke up with a horrible pain in my right eye, the one which had no sight. I went to the infirmary.
You were sitting too close to the TV, the nurse said.
I cannot see at all out of that eye, I said.
Well, you still had no business sitting in front of the TV that way. I'm going to give you some aspirin, and you can come back this afternoon for more. I did go back for more that afternoon, Tuesday morning and afternoon, Wednesday morning and afternoon. School would be out on Thursday, and I knew no one was going to take me to a doctor that near the end of school. Still, the eye hurt so bad, I cried and sweated and cried some more. For 3 days, I laid helplessly while all my friends packed to go home. Next year, Anne, Janice, Jean Hastings, and I would be in Fisher Cottage. Laverne was already there. But my last days in Cook were painful. I couldn't even go say goodbye to Cameron Village for the summer or to the new little restaurant, the Bright Spot, that had opened up. All of us thought it had opened up just for us and became our favorite place to go off campus. On Thursday, Mama and Daddy came to pick me up. I went home and immediately laid down on the bed, as I did not feel like doing anything. When Mama and Daddy realized I was not even happy about being at home, Daddy took me to Winston-Salem to see Dr. Holt. Dr. Holt was extremely concerned about the high pressure in the right eye, well over a measurable scale. Glaucoma, he said. He told us that the eye should have been looked at when it first began. It was determined that I must be admitted to the hospital on an emergency basis to have the eye removed before it burst, and I could lose what sight there was now in the left eye. I couldn't make any decision about how I felt, as the pain was too severe, and all I wanted was to make it stop. I laid in the hospital room feeling sleepy from pain medication. I wondered if I was in the same room that I was when I was in the clinic before, but I didn't care much. I didn't even care about the fact that I was going to have surgery again. "Do I have to have ether?" I asked. "No, we can give you a shot now," Dr. Holt told me. Once the medication eased the pain, I tried to think about what was happening. For 4 days, my head had hurt worse than I ever thought it could. I really didn't want to have my eye removed and get an artificial eye. Some of the students at school had artificial eyes, and they seemed not to care at all. As I remembered the week of pain and the danger of being completely blind, the decision in my mind was easy, and I went with it. So, I began the summer with a still hurting arm from the car accident, a missing eye, and wondering about this thing called blindness. After my first surgery, people were surprised at how much I could see. Sally had bragged on my coloring, even though I could not truly color as pretty as most people and ran out of the lines more than I meant to. I wondered if Sally was going to be in Fisher to help me get used to the artificial eye. She had told me before school was out that she might be going to public school soon. While I lay in bed the day after surgery, my mind seemed to reverse, tracing my years in Cook Cottage. All of us had come through our beginning teens, giggled and talking about boys, music, and true stories. We had 3 different house mothers in 3 years. We all had experienced a hurricane, wore poodle skirts, and laughed at almost everything. I thought about one Sunday afternoon when we were all supposed to be quiet so Mrs. Oates could rest. That was almost impossible for us to do now that we could hardly be quiet at all. It was one of those Sunday afternoons when Laverne, Belvia Maynard, Sherry Barber, and I were playing a silly game we called Grandpa's Raggedy Breeches. Someone would ask one of us in the circle a question, and no matter what the question was, we were supposed to answer with Grandpa's Raggedy Breeches without laughing. As silly as that seems now, it was really funny to very young teens who thought the whole world was just a bit funny anyway. Then Laverne asked me, "What do you think Mrs. Oates would be wearing if she rode on the back of a mule?" Just as I was trying to picture our tired old house mother on the back of the mule while I said Grandpa's Raggedy Breeches without laughing, our room door opened and Mrs. Oates stepped inside. "I heard that," she said. "What kind of talk do you think that is?" "Are you trying to say that I am an old horse?"
As if truly planned, Judy Hall came dancing down the hall as if she had forgotten it was Sunday rest period and sang, "The old gray mare just ain't what she used to be." All of us just couldn't stand it then and just burst into laughter. In spite of our house mother standing rigid inside our room, promising us we would not go to the campus store for 2 weeks. Then there was the evening that Carolyn, Sherry, Laverne, and I decided to have a potato chip race. We all bought a 25-cent bag of chips. In the 1950s, a bag of chips for a quarter was probably as big as a giant bag of chips are today. We were each going to eat an entire bag of chips. And if anyone got sick, we would all three call them a chicken for the entire weekend. I was certain I could eat the entire bag and then some, and proceeded to do just that. It was before supper, and Carolyn was in the bathroom throwing up. I ran into the bathroom going, "Brack, brack, 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 brack." "Myra, stop it," Sherry said. "We really can't make fun of her when she's really sick." I stopped making the chicken noises, but somewhere in my mind I felt gratified that even Carolyn could throw up just like everybody else. Just then the nurse came in. "What were you giggling about? I thought you were asleep," she said. "No, I was just thinking," I answered. "About the surgery?" she asked. No, ma'am," I said. "About school and my friends." "I bet you have lots of friends," she said. "We all are friends," I told her. "We all live together." She then stuck a thermometer under my tongue and told me that she had to give me a pill just as a precaution to keep the pressure down in my other eye. I swallowed the pill, laid back on the pillows, and took up my thoughts once more. My mind wandered the halls of Kay and Cook cottages. I began to think about anyone I knew who had been in the hospital before and remembered Gloria Jean Cutler. Gloria Jean was a tiny little girl when we were in K. She could see pretty good and was playing tag with some of the girls in the big yard. There were benches in the yard. Some of them were iron ones with flat little rails about half inch thick that stuck out on either side of the back of the bench. Gloria ran full speed into one of those benches, immediately collapsing. She had ended up in the hospital. It was a somber night in Kay Cottage as we all wondered about whether or not she would live. She had a ruptured spleen and was out of school for a month, but she did come back. I roomed with Gloria one of those years in Cook Cottage, and I thought about how we had played records and how we had talked about the infirmary and ghost stories we had been told about people who died there. I am sure nobody ever died there, but Gloria had been in the hospital most of her illness. Yet I thought about her now and how much worse her hospital stay had been than mine. This kept me from thinking about my own situation. Still, I dreaded going back to school with an artificial eye. Always, Mama and Daddy had told me that perhaps, someday, there would be a cure for the blindness in my right eye, and I had always believed there would be. Now I knew that could never happen. My mind became dreary at the thoughts as it disappeared inside my nightmare. In the dream, I was running after a man who had stolen my eye, and I was carrying his arm in my hands. I had traded my eye for his arm. I was shouting to him that he had taken the wrong eye, and I now could not see. As I chased him, I ran into Gloria Jean's iron bench, which immediately caused me to start screaming. Several nurses came running. "It was just a dream," they told me, but it took me a while to believe them. Then I realized I was looking at the nurses' white suits and caps, and all with dark hair. "You're just groggy from the anesthesia," one of the nurses said, as she tucked me back under the sheets and kissed the top of my head. I wonder what it was that made people seem to enjoy kissing me on the head. "Think about something you like," she said.
I still wanted to think about the years at Cook Cottage. Mrs. Fine, with the large red bun on the top of her head, crossed my mind. Sally had red hair, too, but Sally's was darker, thicker, and softer. Maybe if Mrs. Fine's hair had been the color of Sally's, she would have been a prettier lady like Mrs. Eubanks. I smiled as I thought about Mrs. Eubanks. Mrs. Eubanks danced with us, sang with us, didn't laugh at our silly giggles, and never punished us. One Sunday in December, Miss Davis had taken me to hear the Messiah at Duke University Chapel. When I came back, Mrs. Eubanks and several girls were listening to the top 10 tunes in Miss Eubanks' room. We did that often, as her room was never off limits to any of us. She even let us use the phone in her room if we wanted to. She began to sing in a real high falsetto voice, imitating opera and doing a little pirouette down the room. "Did you enjoy that highbrow stuff?" she asked. "I didn't think I would," I answered, "but the truth is, it is the most beautiful thing I have ever heard." "My goodness, you are finally growing up," she said, as she squeezed my shoulder and kissed the top of my head. "Growing up," I thought, as I fell back into a natural sleep. Poem. I remember Cook. Giggling girls. Elvis Presley haircuts that took forever to grow out. Radiators that clanged in the mornings as if heat were trying to get in or out. Transistor radios. Pull skirts and ponytails. The bop. States and capitals. Meeting Pat Boone. What a caterpillar cocoon feels like. Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, and Little Women in Braille. What a period really is. Handel's Messiah. My first Braille watch. 3 different house mothers in 3 years. Hose with seams down the back and garters to hold them up. Giggling girls.
You are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This ends Disc 3.